desert, a parched, desolate 600-mile strip caught in the leeward shadow of the giant furl of the Andes that stretches from southern Peru into Chile. Brushed continuously by a warm, desiccating wind, the terrain hasn't seen rain in recorded history. It is hard to imagine that human life once flourished here, but it did. The plain is strewn with hundreds of graves, small, shallow pits dug out of the clay, then lined carefully with rock. Over the centuries, dogs, storms, and grave robbers have dug out these shallow graves, exhuming history. The graves contain the mummified remains of members of the Chiribaya tribe. The Chiribaya made no effort to preserve their dead, but the climate is almost providentially perfect for mummification. The clay leaches water and fluids out of the body from below, and the wind dries the tissues from above. The bodies, often placed seated, are thus swiftly frozen in time and space. In 1990, one such large desiccated gravesite, containing about 140 bodies, caught the attention of Arthur Aufderheide, a professor at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. Aufderheide is a pathologist by training, but his specialty is paleopathology, a study of ancient specimens. His autopsies, unlike Farber's, are not performed on recently living patients, but on the mummified remains found on archaeological sites. He stores these human specimens in small, sterile milk containers in a vault-like chamber in Minnesota. There are nearly 5,000 pieces of tissue, scores of biopsies, and hundreds of broken skeletons in his closet. At the Chiribaya site, Aufderheide rigged up a makeshift dissecting table and performed 140 autopsies over several weeks. One body revealed an extraordinary finding. The mummy was of a young woman in her mid-30s, found sitting, with her feet curled up, in a shallow clay grave. When Aufderheide examined her, his fingers found a hard, bulbous mass in her left upper arm. The papery folds of skin, remarkably preserved, gave way to that mass, which was intact and studded with spicules of bone. This, without question, was a malignant bone tumor, an osteosarcoma, a thousand-year-old cancer preserved inside of a mummy. Aufderheide suspects that the tumor had broken through the skin while she was still alive. Even small osteosarcomas can be unimaginably painful. The woman's pain, he suggests, must have been blindingly intense. Aufderheide isn't the only paleopathologist to have found cancers in mummified specimens. Bone tumors, because they form hardened and calcified tissue, are vastly more likely to survive over centuries and are best preserved. There are other cancers found in mummies where the malignant tissue has been preserved. The oldest of these is an abdominal cancer from Dakhla in Egypt from about 400 AD, he said. In other cases, paleopathologists have not found the actual tumors, but rather signs left by the tumors in the body. Some skeletons were riddled with tiny holes created by cancer in the skull or the shoulder bones, all arising from metastatic skin or breast cancer. In 1914, a team of archaeologists found a 2,000-year-old Egyptian mummy in the Alexandrian catacombs with a tumor invading the pelvic bone. Louis Leakey, the anthropologist who dug up some of the earliest known human skeletons, also discovered a jawbone dating from 2 million years ago from a nearby site that carried the signs of a peculiar form of lymphoma found endemically in southeastern Africa, although the origin of that tumor was never confirmed pathologically. If that finding does represent an ancient mark of malignancy, then cancer, far from being a modern disease, is one of the oldest diseases ever seen in a human specimen, quite possibly the oldest. The most striking finding, though, is not that cancer existed in the distant past, but that it was fleetingly rare. When I asked Aufderheide about this, he laughed. The early history of cancer, he said, is that there is very little early history of cancer. The Mesopotamians knew their migraines. The Egyptians had a word for seizures. A leprosy-like illness, Sara'at, is mentioned in the Book of Leviticus. The Hindu Vedas have a medical term for dropsy and a goddess specifically dedicated to smallpox. Tuberculosis was so omnipresent and familiar to the ancients that, as with ice and the Eskimos, distinct words exist for each incarnation of it. But even common cancers, such as breast, lung, and prostate, are conspicuously absent. With a few notable exceptions, in a vast stretch of medical history, there is no book or god for cancer. There are several reasons behind this absence. Cancer is an age-related disease, sometimes exponentially so. The risk of breast cancer, for instance, is about 1 in 400 for a 30-year-old woman and increases to 1 in 9 for a 70-year-old. In most ancient societies, people didn't live long enough to get cancer. Men and women were long consumed by tuberculosis, dropsy, cholera, smallpox, leprosy, plague, or pneumonia. If cancer existed, it remained submerged under the sea of other illnesses. Indeed, cancer's emergence in the world is the product of a double negative. It becomes common only when all other killers themselves have been killed. 19th century doctors often linked cancer to civilization. Cancer, they imagined, was caused by the rush and whirl of modern life, which somehow incited pathological growth in the body. The link was correct, but the causality was not. Civilization did not cause cancer, but by extending human lifespans, civilization unveiled it. Longevity, though certainly the most important contributor to the prevalence of cancer in the early 20th century, is probably not the only contributor. Our capacity to detect cancer earlier and earlier, and to attribute deaths accurately to it, has also dramatically increased in the last century. The death of a child with leukemia in the 1850s would have been attributed to an abscess or infection, or, as Bennett would have it, to a suppuration of blood. And surgery, biopsy, and autopsy techniques have further sharpened our ability to diagnose cancer. The introduction of mammography to detect breast cancer early in its course sharply increased its incidence, a seemingly paradoxical result that makes perfect sense when we realize that the X-rays allow earlier tumors to be diagnosed. Finally, changes in the structure of modern life have radically shifted the spectrum of cancers, increasing the incidence of some, decreasing the incidence of others. Stomach cancer, for instance, was highly prevalent in certain populations until the late 19th century, likely the result of several carcinogens found in pickling reagents and preservatives, and exacerbated by endemic and contagious infection with a bacterium that causes stomach cancer. With the introduction of modern refrigeration, and possibly changes in public hygiene that have diminished the rate of endemic infection, the stomach cancer epidemic seems to have abated. In contrast, lung cancer incidence in men increased dramatically in the 1950s as a result of an increase in cigarette smoking during the early 20th century. In women, a cohort that began to smoke in the 1950s, lung cancer incidence has yet to reach its peak. The consequence of these demographic and epidemiological shifts was and is enormous. In 1900, as Roswell Park noted, tuberculosis was by far the most common cause of death in America. Behind tuberculosis came pneumonia. William Osler, the famous physician from Johns Hopkins University, called it captain of the men of death, diarrhea, and gastroenteritis. Cancer still lagged at a distant seventh. By the early 1940s, cancer had ratcheted its way to second on the list, immediately behind heart disease. In that same span, life expectancy among Americans had increased by about 26 years. The proportion of persons above 60 years, the age when most cancers begin to strike, nearly doubled. But the rarity of ancient cancers notwithstanding, it is impossible to forget the tumor growing in the bone of Aufderheide's mummy of a 35-year-old. The woman must have wondered about the insolent gnaw of pain in her bone and the bulge slowly emerging from her arm. It is hard to look at the tumor and not come away with the feeling that one has encountered a powerful monster in its infancy. Onchus. Black bile without boiling causes cancers. Galen, AD 130. We have learned nothing, therefore, about the real cause of cancer or its actual nature. We are where the Greeks were. Francis Carter Wood, in 1914. It's bad bile, it's bad habits, it's bad bosses, it's bad genes. Mel Greaves, Cancer, The Evolutionary Legacy, 2000. In some ways, disease does not exist until we have agreed that it does, by perceiving, naming, and responding to it. C. E. Rosenberg. Even an ancient monster needs a name. To name an illness is to describe a certain condition of suffering, a literary act before it becomes a medical one. A patient, long before he becomes the subject of medical scrutiny, is at first simply a storyteller, a narrator of suffering, a traveler who has visited the kingdom of the ill. To relieve an illness, one must begin, then, by unburdening its story. The names of ancient illnesses are condensed stories in their own right. Typhus, a stormy disease with erratic, vaporous fevers, arose from the Greek typhon, the father of winds, a word that also gives rise to the modern typhoon. Influenza emerged from the Latin influentia, because medieval doctors imagined that the cyclical epidemics of flu were influenced by stars and planets revolving toward and away from the earth. Tuberculosis, coagulated out of the Latin tuber, referring to the swollen lumps of glands that looked like small vegetables. Lymphatic tuberculosis, TB of the lymph glands, was called scrofula, from the Latin word for piglet, evoking the rather morbid image of a chain of swollen glands arranged in a line like a group of suckling pigs. It was in the time of Hippocrates, around 400 BC, that a word for cancer first appeared in the medical literature. Carcinos, from the Greek word for crab. The tumor, with its clutch of swollen blood vessels around it, reminded Hippocrates of a crab dug in the sand, with its legs spread in a circle. The image was peculiar. Few cancers truly resemble crabs, but also vivid. Later writers, both doctors and patients, added embellishments. For some, the hardened, matted surface of the tumor was reminiscent of the tough carapace of a crab's body. Others felt a crab moving under the flesh as the disease spread stealthily throughout the body. For yet others, the sudden stab of pain produced by the disease was like being caught in the grip of a crab's pincers. Another Greek word would intersect with the history of cancer. Onchus, a word used occasionally to describe tumors, from which the discipline of oncology would take its modern name. Onchos was the Greek term for a mass or a load, or more commonly, a burden. Cancer was imagined as a burden carried by the body. In Greek theater, the same word, onchos, would be used to denote a tragic mask that was often burdened with an unwieldy conical weight on its head to denote the psychic load carried by its wearer. But while these vivid metaphors might resonate with our contemporary understanding of cancer, what Hippocrates called carcinos and the disease that we now know as cancer were, in fact, vastly different creatures. Hippocrates' carcinos were mostly large, superficial tumors that were easily visible to the eye. Cancers of the breast, skin, jaw, neck, and tongue. Even the distinction between malignant and non-malignant tumors likely escaped Hippocrates. His carcinos included every conceivable form of swelling. Nodes, carbuncles, polyps, protrusions, tubercles, pustules, and glands. Lumps lumped indiscriminately into the same category of pathology. The Greeks had no microscopes. They had never imagined an entity called a cell, let alone seen one, and the idea that carcinos was the uncontrolled growth of cells could not possibly have occurred to them. They were, however, preoccupied with fluid mechanics, with water wheels, pistons, valves, chambers, and sluices, a revolution in hydraulic science originating with irrigation and canal digging and culminating with Archimedes discovering his eponymous laws in his bathtub. This preoccupation with hydraulics also flowed into Greek medicine and pathology. To explain illness, all illness, Hippocrates fashioned an elaborate doctrine based on fluids and volumes, which he freely applied to pneumonia, boils, dysentery, and hemorrhoids. The human body, Hippocrates proposed, was composed of four cardinal fluids called humors: blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. Each of these fluids had a unique color, red, black, yellow, and white, viscosity, and essential character. In the normal body, these four fluids were held in perfect, if somewhat precarious, balance. In illness, this balance was upset by the excess of one fluid. The physician Claudius Galen, a prolific writer and influential Greek doctor who practiced among the Romans around AD 160, brought Hippocrates' humoral theory to its apogee. Like Hippocrates, Galen set about classifying all illnesses in terms of excesses of various fluids. Inflammation, a red-hot, painful distension, was attributed to an overabundance of blood. Tubercles, pustules, catarrh, and nodules of lymph, all cool, boggy, and white, were excesses of phlegm. Jaundice was the overflow of yellow bile. For cancer, Galen reserved the most malevolent and disquieting of the four humors, black bile. Only one other disease, replete with metaphors, would be attributed to an excess of this oily, viscous humor: depression. Indeed, melancholia, the medieval name for depression, would draw its name from the Greek melas, black, and kole, bile. Depression and cancer, the psychic and physical diseases of black bile, were thus intrinsically intertwined. Galen proposed that cancer was trapped black bile, static bile unable to escape from a site and thus congealed into a matted mass. Of black color bile, without boiling, cometh cancer. Thomas Gale, the English surgeon, wrote of Galen's theory in the 16th century, "And if the humor be sharp, it maketh ulceration, and for this cause, these tumors are more blacker in color." That short, vivid description would have a profound impact on the future of oncology, much broader than Galen, or Gale, may have intended. Cancer, Galenic theory suggested, was the result of a systemic malignant state, an internal overdose of black bile. Tumors were just local outcroppings of a deep-seated bodily dysfunction, an imbalance of physiology that had pervaded the entire corpus. Hippocrates had once abstrusely opined that cancer was best left untreated, since patients live longer that way. 5 centuries later, Galen had explained his teacher's gnomic musings in a fantastical swoop of physiological conjecture. The problem with treating cancer surgically, Galen suggested, was that black bile was everywhere, as inevitable and pervasive as any fluid. You could cut cancer out, but the bile would flow right back, like sap seeping through the limbs of a tree. Galen died in Rome in 199 AD, but his influence on medicine stretched over the centuries. The black bile theory of cancer was so metaphorically seductive that it clung on tenaciously in the minds of doctors. The surgical removal of tumors, a local solution to a systemic problem, was thus perceived as a fool's operation. Generations of surgeons layered their own observations on Galen's, solidifying the theory even further. "Do not be led away and offer to operate," John of Arden wrote in the mid-1300s. "It will only be a disgrace to you." Leonard Bertipaglia, perhaps the most influential surgeon of the 15th century, added his own admonishment. "Those who pretend to cure cancer by incising, lifting, and extirpating it only transform a non-ulcerous cancer into an ulcerous one. In all my practice, I have never seen a cancer cured by incision, nor known anyone who has." Unwittingly, Galen may actually have done the future victims of cancer a favor, at least a temporary one. In the absence of anesthesia and antibiotics, most surgical operations performed in the dank chamber of a medieval clinic, or more typically, in the back room of a barber shop with a rusty knife and leather straps for restraints, were disastrous, life-threatening affairs. The 16th-century surgeon Ambroise Paré described charring tumors with a soldering iron heated on coals, or chemically searing them with a paste of sulfuric acid. Even a small nick in the skin, treated thus, could quickly suppurate into a lethal infection. The tumors would often profusely bleed at the slightest provocation. Lorenz Heister, an 18th-century German physician, once described a mastectomy in his clinic as if it were a sacrificial ritual. "Many females can stand the operation with the greatest courage and without hardly moaning at all. Others, however, make such a clamor that they may dishearten even the most undaunted surgeon and hinder the operation. To perform the operation, the surgeon should be steadfast and not allow himself to become discomforted by the cries of the patient." Unsurprisingly, rather than take their chances with such undaunted surgeons, most patients chose to hang their fates with Galen and try systemic medicines to purge the black bile. The apothecary thus soon filled up with an enormous list of remedies for cancer: tincture of lead, extracts of arsenic, boar's tooth, fox lungs, rasped ivory, hulled castor, ground white coral, ipecac, senna, and a smattering of purgatives and laxatives. There was alcohol and the tincture of opium for intractable pain. In the 17th century, a paste of crab's eyes at 5 shillings a pound was popular, using fire to treat fire. The ointments and salves grew increasingly bizarre by the century: goat's dung, frogs, crow's feet, dog fennel, tortoise liver, the laying of hands, blessed waters, or the compression of the tumor with lead plates. Despite Galen's advice, an occasional small tumor was still surgically excised. Even Galen had reportedly performed such surgeries, possibly for cosmetic or palliative reasons. But the idea of surgical removal of cancer as a curative treatment was entertained only in the most extreme circumstances. When medicines and operations failed, doctors resorted to the only established treatment for cancer, borrowed from Galen's teachings: an intricate series of bleeding and purging rituals to squeeze the humors out of the body, as if it were an overfilled, heavy sponge. Vanishing humors. "Racked carcasses make ill anatomies." John Donne. In the winter of 1533, a 19-year-old student from Brussels, Andreas Vesalius, arrived at the University of Paris hoping to learn Galenic anatomy and pathology and to start a practice in surgery. To Vesalius's shock and disappointment, the anatomy lessons at the university were in a preposterous state of disarray. The school lacked a specific space for performing dissections. The basement of the Hôpital Dieu, where anatomy demonstrations were held, was a theatrically macabre space where instructors hacked their way through decaying cadavers while dogs gnawed on bones and drippings below. Aside from the 8 muscles of the abdomen, badly mangled and in the wrong order, no one had ever shown a muscle to me, nor any bone, much less the succession of nerves, veins, and arteries, Vesalius wrote in a letter. Without a map of human organs to guide them, surgeons were left to hack their way through the body like sailors sent to sea without a map, the blind leading the ill. Frustrated with these ad hoc dissections, Vesalius decided to create his own anatomical map. He needed his own specimens, and he began to scour the graveyards around Paris for bones and bodies. At Montfaucon, he stumbled upon the massive gibbet of the city of Paris, where the bodies of petty prisoners were often left dangling. A few miles away, at the Cemetery of the Innocents, the skeletons of victims of the Great Plague lay half exposed in their graves, eroded down to the bone. The gibbet and the graveyard, the convenience stores for the medieval anatomist, yielded specimen after specimen for Vesalius, and he compulsively raided them, often returning twice a day to cut pieces dangling from the chains and smuggle them off to his dissection chamber. Anatomy came alive for him in this grisly world of the dead. In 1538, collaborating with artists in Titian's studio, Vesalius began to publish his detailed drawings in plates and books, elaborate and delicate etchings charting the courses of arteries and veins, mapping nerves and lymph nodes. In some plates, he pulled away layers of tissue, exposing the delicate surgical planes underneath. In another drawing, he sliced through the brain in deft horizontal sections, a human CT scanner, centuries before its time, to demonstrate the relationship between the cisterns and the ventricles. Vesalius's anatomical project had started as a purely intellectual exercise, but was soon propelled toward a pragmatic need. Galen's humoral theory of disease, that all diseases were pathological accumulations of the 4 cardinal fluids, required that patients be bled and purged to squeeze the culprit humors out of the body. But for the bleedings to be successful, they had to be performed at specific sites in the body. If the patient was to be bled prophylactically, that is, to prevent disease, then the purging was to be performed far away from the possible disease site, so that the humors could be diverted from it. But if the patient was being bled therapeutically, to cure an established disease, then the bleeding had to be done from nearby vessels leading into the site. To clarify this already foggy theory, Galen had borrowed an equally foggy Hippocratic expression, kat ixi, Greek for straight into, to describe isolating the vessels that led straight into tumors. But Galen's terminology had pitched physicians into further confusion. What on earth, they wondered, had Galen meant by straight into? Which vessels led straight into a tumor or an organ, and which led the way out? The instructions became a maze of misunderstanding. In the absence of a systematic anatomical map, without the establishment of normality, abnormal anatomy was impossible to fathom. Vesalius decided to solve the problem by systematically sketching out every blood vessel and nerve in the body, producing an anatomical atlas for surgeons. In the course of explaining the opinion of the divine Hippocrates and Galen, he wrote in a letter, I happened to delineate the veins on a chart, thinking that thus I might be able easily to demonstrate what Hippocrates understood by the expression kat ixi. For you know how much dissension and controversy on venesection was stirred up, even among the learned. But having started this project, Vesalius found that he could not stop. My drawing of the veins pleased the professors of medicine and all the students so much that they earnestly sought from me a diagram of the arteries and also one of the nerves. I could not disappoint them. The body was endlessly interconnected. Veins ran parallel to nerves. The nerves were connected to the spinal cord, the cord to the brain, and so forth. Anatomy could only be captured in its totality. And soon the project became so gargantuan and complex that it had to be outsourced to yet other illustrators to complete. But no matter how diligently Vesalius pored through the body, he could not find Galen's black bile. The word autopsy comes from the Greek to see for oneself. As Vesalius learned to see for himself, he could no longer force Galen's mystical visions to fit his own. The lymphatic system carried a pale, watery fluid. The blood vessels were filled, as expected, with blood. Yellow bile was in the liver. But black bile, Galen's oozing carrier of cancer and depression, could not be found anywhere. Vesalius now found himself in a strange position. He had emerged from a tradition steeped in Galenic scholarship. He had studied, edited, and republished Galen's books. But black bile, that glistening centerpiece of Galen's physiology, was nowhere to be found. Vesalius hedged about his discovery. Guiltily, he heaped even more praise on the long-dead Galen. But an empiricist to the core, Vesalius left his drawings just as he saw things, leaving others to draw their own conclusions. There was no black bile. Vesalius had started his anatomical project to save Galen's theory, but in the end, he quietly buried it. In 1793, Matthew Bailey, an anatomist in London, published a textbook called The Morbid Anatomy of Some of the Most Important Parts of the Human Body. Bailey's book, written for surgeons and anatomists, was the obverse of Vesalius's project. If Vesalius had mapped out normal anatomy, Bailey mapped the body in its diseased, abnormal state. It was Vesalius's study read through an inverted lens. Galen's fantastical speculations about illness were even more at stake here. Black bile may not have existed discernibly in normal tissue, but tumors should have been chock full of it. But none was to be found. Bailey described cancers of the lung, as large as an orange, stomach, a fungus appearance, and the testicles, a foul, deep ulcer, and provided vivid engravings of these tumors. But he could not find the channels of bile anywhere, not even in his orange-sized tumors, nor in the deepest cavities of his foul, deep ulcers. If Galen's web of invisible fluids existed, then it existed outside tumors, outside the pathological world, outside the boundaries of normal anatomical inquiry. In short, outside medical science. Like Vesalius, Bailey drew anatomy and cancer the way he actually saw it. At long last, the vivid channels of black bile, the humors and the tumors that had so gripped the minds of doctors and patients for centuries, vanished from the picture. Remote sympathy. In treating of cancer, we shall remark that little or no confidence should be placed either in internal remedies, and that there is nothing except the total separation of the part affected. A Dictionary of Practical Surgery, 1836. Matthew Bailey's Morbid Anatomy laid the intellectual foundation for the surgical extractions of tumors. If black bile did not exist, as Bailey had discovered, then removing cancer surgically might indeed rid the body of the disease. But surgery as a discipline was not yet ready for such operations. In the 1760s, a Scottish surgeon, John Hunter, Bailey's maternal uncle, had started to remove tumors from his patients in a clinic in London, in quiet defiance of Galen's teachings. But Hunter's elaborate studies initially performed on animals and cadavers in a shadowy menagerie in his own house, were stuck at a critical bottleneck. He could nimbly reach down into the tumors, and if they were movable, as he called superficial, non-invasive cancers, pull them out without disturbing the tender architecture of tissues underneath. If a tumor is not only movable, but the part naturally so, Hunter wrote, they may be safely removed also. But it requires great caution to know if any of these consequent tumors are within proper reach, for we are apt to be deceived. That last sentence was crucial. Albeit crudely, Hunter had begun to classify tumors into stages. Movable tumors were typically early-stage local cancers. Immovable tumors were advanced, invasive, and even metastatic. Hunter concluded that only movable cancers were worth removing surgically. For more advanced forms of cancer, he advised an honest, if chilling, remedy reminiscent of Imhotep's, remote sympathy. Hunter used this term both to describe metastatic, remotely disseminated cancer, and to argue that therapy was useless. Hunter was an immaculate anatomist, but his surgical mind was far ahead of his hand. A reckless and restless man with nearly maniacal energy, who slept only 4 hours a night, Hunter had practiced his surgical skills endlessly on cadavers from every nook of the animal kingdom. On monkeys, sharks, walruses, pheasants, bears, and ducks. But with live human patients, he found himself at a standstill. Even if he worked at breakneck speed, having drugged his patient with alcohol and opium to near oblivion, the leap from cool, bloodless corpses to live patients was fraught with danger. As if the pain during surgery were not bad enough, the threat of infections after surgery loomed. Those who survived the terrifying crucible of the operating table often died even more miserable deaths in their own beds soon afterward. In the brief span between 1846 and 1867, two discoveries swept away these two quandaries that had haunted surgery, thus allowing cancer surgeons to revisit the bold procedures that Hunter had tried to perfect in London. The first of these discoveries, anesthesia, was publicly demonstrated in 1846 in a packed surgical amphitheater at Massachusetts General Hospital, less than 10 miles from where Sidney Farber's basement laboratory would be located a century later. At about 10 o'clock on the morning of October 16th, a group of doctors gathered in a pit-like room at the center of the hospital. A Boston dentist, William Morton, unveiled a small glass vaporizer containing about a quart of ether, fitted with an inhaler. He opened the nozzle and asked the patient, Edward Abbott, a printer, to take a few whiffs of the vapor. As Abbott lulled into a deep sleep, a surgeon stepped into the center of the amphitheater and with a few brisk strokes deftly made a small incision in Abbott's neck and closed a swollen, malformed blood vessel, referred to as a tumor, conflating malignant and benign swellings, with a quick stitch. When Abbott awoke a few minutes later, he said, "I did not experience pain at any time, though I knew that the operation was proceeding." Anesthesia, the dissociation of pain from surgery, allowed surgeons to perform prolonged operations, often lasting several hours. But the hurdle of post-surgical infection remained. Until the mid-19th century, such infections were common and universally lethal, but their cause remained a mystery. It must be some subtle principle contained in the wound, one surgeon concluded in 1819, which eludes the sight. In 1865, a Scottish surgeon named Joseph Lister made an unusual conjecture on how to neutralize that subtle principle lurking elusively in the wound. Lister began with an old clinical observation. Wounds left open to the air would quickly turn gangrenous, while closed wounds would often remain clean and uninfected. In the post-surgical wards of the Glasgow Infirmary, Lister had again and again seen an angry red margin begin to spread out from the wound, and then the skin seemed to rot from inside out, often followed by fever, pus, and a swift death, a bona fide suppuration. Lister thought of a distant, seemingly unrelated experiment. In Paris, Louis Pasteur, the great French chemist, had shown that meat broth left exposed to the air would soon turn turbid and begin to ferment, while meat broth sealed in a sterilized vacuum jar would remain clear. Based on these observations, Pasteur had made a bold claim. The turbidity was caused by the growth of invisible microorganisms, bacteria, that had fallen out of the air into the broth. Lister took Pasteur's reasoning further. An open wound, a mixture of clotted blood and denuded flesh, was, after all, a human variant of Pasteur's meat broth, a natural petri dish for bacterial growth. Could the bacteria that had dropped into Pasteur's cultures in France also be dropping out of the air into Lister's patients' wounds in Scotland? Lister then made another inspired leap of logic. If post-surgical infections were being caused by bacteria, then perhaps an antibacterial process or chemical could curb these infections. It occurred to me, he wrote in his clinical notes, that the decomposition in the injured part might be avoided without excluding the air, by applying as a dressing some material capable of destroying the life of the floating particles. In the neighboring town of Carlisle, Lister had observed sewage disposers cleanse their waste with a cheap, sweet-smelling liquid containing carbolic acid. Lister began to apply carbolic acid paste to wounds after surgery. That he was applying a sewage cleanser to his patients appears not to have struck him as even the slightest bit unusual. In August 1867, a 13-year-old boy who had severely cut his arm while operating a machine at a fair in Glasgow was admitted to Lister's infirmary. The boy's wound was open and smeared with grime, a setup for gangrene. But rather than amputating the arm, Lister tried a salve of carbolic acid, hoping to keep the arm alive and uninfected. The wound teetered on the edge of a terrifying infection, threatening to become an abscess. But Lister persisted, intensifying his application of carbolic acid paste. For a few weeks, the whole effort seemed hopeless. But then, like a fire running to the end of a rope, the wound began to dry up. A month later, when the poultices were removed, the skin had completely healed underneath. It was not long before Lister's invention was joined to the advancing front of cancer surgery. In 1869, Lister removed a breast tumor from his sister, Isabella Pym, using a dining table as his operating table, ether for anesthesia, and carbolic acid as his antiseptic. She survived without an infection, although she would eventually die of liver metastasis 3 years later. A few months later, Lister performed an extensive amputation on another patient with cancer, likely a sarcoma in a thigh. By the mid-1870s, Lister was routinely operating on breast cancer and had extended his surgery to the cancer-afflicted lymph nodes under the breast. Antisepsis and anesthesia were twin technological breakthroughs that released surgery from its constraining medieval chrysalis. Armed with ether and carbolic soap, a new generation of surgeons lunged toward the forbiddingly complex anatomical procedures that Hunter and his colleagues had once concocted on cadavers. An incandescent century of cancer surgery emerged. Between 1850 to 1950, surgeons brazenly attacked cancer by cutting open the body and removing tumors. Emblematic of this era was the prolific Viennese surgeon Theodor Billroth. Born in 1821, Billroth studied music and surgery with almost equal verve. The professions still often go hand in hand. Both push manual skill to its limit, both mature with practice and age, both depend on immediacy, precision, and opposable thumbs. In 1867, as a professor in Berlin, Billroth launched a systematic study of methods to open the human abdomen to remove malignant masses. Until Billroth's time, the mortality following abdominal surgery had been forbidding. Billroth's approach to the problem was meticulous and formal. For nearly a decade, he spent surgery after surgery simply opening and closing abdomens of animals and human cadavers, defining clear and safe routes to the inside. By the early 1880s, he had established the routes. "The course so far is already sufficient proof that the operation is possible," he wrote. "Our next care, and the subject of our next studies, must be to determine the indications and to develop the technique to suit all kinds of cases. I hope we have taken another good step forward towards securing unfortunate people hitherto regarded as incurable." At the Allgemeines Krankenhaus, the teaching hospital in Vienna where he was appointed a professor, Billroth and his students now began to master and use a variety of techniques to remove tumors from the stomach, colon, ovaries, and esophagus, hoping to cure the body of cancer. The switch from exploration to cure produced an unanticipated challenge. A cancer surgeon's task was to remove malignant tissue while leaving normal tissues and organs intact. But this task, Billroth soon discovered, demanded a nearly godlike creative spirit. Since the time of Vesalius, surgery had been immersed in the study of natural anatomy. But cancer so often disobeyed and distorted natural anatomical boundaries that unnatural boundaries had to be invented to constrain it. To remove the distal end of a stomach filled with cancer, for instance, Billroth had to hook up the pouch remaining after surgery to a nearby piece of the small intestine. To remove the entire bottom half of the stomach, he had to attach the remainder to a piece of distant jejunum. By the mid-1890s, Billroth had operated on 41 patients with gastric carcinoma using these novel anatomical reconfigurations. 19 of these patients had survived the surgery. These procedures represented pivotal advances in the treatment of cancer. By the early 20th century, many locally restricted cancers, i.e., primary tumors without metastatic lesions, could be removed by surgery. These included uterine and ovarian cancer, breast and prostate cancer, colon cancer, and lung cancer. If these tumors were removed before they had invaded other organs, these operations produced cures in a significant fraction of patients. But despite these remarkable advances, some cancers, even seemingly locally restricted ones, still relapsed after surgery, prompting second and often third attempts to resect tumors. Surgeons returned to the operating table and cut again, as if caught in a cat-and-mouse game, as cancer was slowly excavated out of the human body, piece by piece. But what if the whole of cancer could be uprooted at its earliest stage using the most definitive surgery conceivable? What if cancer, incurable by means of conventional local surgery, could be cured by a radical, aggressive operation that would dig out its roots so completely, so exhaustively, that no possible trace was left behind? In an era captivated by the potency and creativity of surgeons, the idea of a surgeon's knife extracting cancer by its roots was imbued with promise and wonder. It would land on the already brittle and combustible world of oncology like a firecracker thrown into gunpowder. A radical idea. The professor who blesses the occasion which permits him to explain something profound nears me and is pleased to direct me. "Amputate the breast." "Pardon me," I said with sadness, "but I had forgotten the operation." Rudolfo Figueroa, in Poet Physicians. It is over. She is dressed, steps gently and decently down from the table, looks for James. Then, Turning to the surgeon and the students, she curtsies, and in a low, clear voice, begs their pardon if she has behaved ill. The students, all of us, wept like children. The surgeon happed her up. John Brown, describing a 19th-century mastectomy. William Stuart Halsted, whose name was to be inseparably attached to the concept of radical surgery, did not ask for that distinction. Instead, it was handed to him almost without any asking, like a scalpel delivered wordlessly into the outstretched hand of a surgeon. Halsted didn't invent radical surgery. He inherited the idea from his predecessors and brought it to its extreme and logical perfection, only to find it inextricably attached to his name. Halsted was born in 1852, the son of a well-to-do clothing merchant in New York. He finished high school at the Phillips Academy in Andover and attended Yale College, where his athletic prowess, rather than academic achievement, drew the attention of his teachers and mentors. He wandered into the world of surgery almost by accident, attending medical school not because he was driven to become a surgeon, but because he could not imagine himself apprenticed as a merchant in his father's business. In 1874, Halsted matriculated at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia. He was immediately fascinated by anatomy. This fascination, like many of Halsted's other interests in his later years, purebred dogs, horses, starched tablecloths, linen shirts, Parisian leather shoes, and immaculate surgical sutures, soon grew into an obsessive quest. He swallowed textbooks of anatomy whole, and when the books were exhausted, moved on to real patients with an equally insatiable hunger. In the mid-1870s, Halsted passed an entrance examination to be a surgical intern at Bellevue, a New York City hospital swarming with surgical patients. He split his time between the medical school and the surgical clinic, traveling several miles across New York between Bellevue and Columbia. Understandably, by the time he had finished medical school, he had already suffered a nervous breakdown. He recuperated for a few weeks on Block Island, then, dusting himself off, resumed his studies with just as much energy and verve. This pattern, heroic, Olympian exertion to the brink of physical impossibility, often followed by a near collapse, was to become a hallmark of Halsted's approach to nearly every challenge. It would leave an equally distinct mark on his approach to surgery, surgical education, and cancer. Halsted entered surgery at a transitional moment in its history. Bloodletting, cupping, leeching, and purging were common procedures. One woman with convulsions and fever from a post-surgical infection was treated with even more barbaric attempts at surgery. "I opened a large orifice in each arm," her surgeon wrote with self-congratulatory enthusiasm in the 1850s, "and cut both temporal arteries and had her blood flowing freely from all at the same time, determined to bleed her until the convulsions ceased." Another doctor, prescribing a remedy for lung cancer, wrote, "Small bleedings give temporary relief, although, of course, they cannot often be repeated." At Bellevue, the interns ran about in corridors with pus pails, the bodily drippings of patients spilling out of them. Surgical sutures were made of catgut, sharpened with spit, and left to hang from incisions into the open air. Surgeons walked around with their scalpels dangling from their pockets. If a tool fell on the blood-soiled floor, it was dusted off and inserted back into the pocket, or into the body of the patient on the operating table. In October 1877, leaving behind this gruesome medical world of purgers, bleeders, pus pails, and quacks, Halsted traveled to Europe to visit the clinics of London, Paris, Berlin, Vienna, or Leipzig, where young American surgeons were typically sent to learn refined European surgical techniques. The timing was fortuitous. Halsted arrived in Europe when cancer surgery was just emerging from its chrysalis. In the high Baroque surgical amphitheaters of the Allgemeines Krankenhaus in Vienna, Theodor Billroth was teaching his students novel techniques to dissect the stomach. The complete surgical removal of cancer, Bill Roach told his students, was merely an audacious step away. At Halle, a few hundred miles from Vienna, the German surgeon Richard von Volkmann was working on a technique to operate on breast cancer. Halstead met the giants of European surgery, Hans Chiari, who had meticulously deconstructed the anatomy of the liver, Anton Wulfler, who had studied with Billroth and was learning to dissect the thyroid gland. For Halstead, this whirlwind tour through Berlin, Halle, Zurich, London, and Vienna was an intellectual baptism. When he returned to practice in New York in the early 1880s, his mind was spinning with the ideas he had encountered in his journey. Lister's carbolic sprays, Folkman's early attempts at cancer surgery, and Billroth's miraculous abdominal operations. Energized and inspired, Halstead threw himself to work, operating on patients at Roosevelt Hospital, at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia, at Bellevue, and at Chambers Hospital. Bold, inventive, and daring, his confidence in his handiwork boomed. In 1882, he removed an infected gallbladder from his mother on a kitchen table, successfully performing one of the first such operations in America. Called urgently to see his sister, who was bleeding heavily after childbirth, he withdrew his own blood and transfused her with it. He had no knowledge of blood types, but fortunately, Halstead and his sister were a perfect match. In 1884, at the prime of his career in New York, Halstead read a paper describing the use of a new surgical anesthetic called cocaine. At Halle, in Folkman's clinic, he had watched German surgeons perform operations using this drug. It was cheap, accessible, foolproof, and easy to dose, the fast food of surgical anesthesia. His experimental curiosity aroused, Halstead began to inject himself with the drug, testing it before using it to numb patients for his ambitious surgeries. He found that it produced much more than a transitory numbness. It amplified his instinct for tirelessness. It synergized with his already manic energy. His mind became, as one observer put it, clearer and clearer, with no sense of fatigue and no desire or ability to sleep. He had, it would seem, conquered all his mortal imperfections, the need to sleep, exhaustion, and nihilism. His restive personality had met its perfect pharmacological match. For the next 5 years, Halstead sustained an incredible career as a young surgeon in New York, despite a fierce and growing addiction to cocaine. He wrested some control over his addiction by heroic self-denial and discipline. At night, he reportedly left a sealed vial of cocaine by his bedside, thus testing himself by constantly having the drug within arm's reach. But he relapsed often and fiercely, unable to ever fully overcome his habit. He voluntarily entered the Butler Sanatorium in Providence, where he was treated with morphine to treat his cocaine habit, in essence, exchanging one addiction for another. In 1889, still oscillating between the two highly addictive drugs, yet still astonishingly productive in his surgical clinic in New York, he was recruited to the newly built Johns Hopkins Hospital by the renowned physician William Welch, in part to start a new surgical department and in equal part to wrest him out of his New York world of isolation, overwork, and drug addiction. Hopkins was meant to change Halstead, and it did. Gregarious and outgoing in his former life, he withdrew sharply into a cocooned and private empire where things were controlled, clean, and perfect. He launched an awe-inspiring training program for young surgical residents that would build them in his own image, a superhuman initiation into a superhuman profession that emphasized heroism, self-denial, diligence, and tirelessness. It will be objected that this apprenticeship is too long, that the young surgeons will be stale, he wrote in 1904, but these positions are not for those who so soon weary of the study of their profession. He married Carolyn Hampton, formerly his chief nurse, and lived in a sprawling three-story mansion on the top of a hill, cold as stone and most unlivable, as one of his students described it, each residing on a separate floor. childless, socially awkward, formal, and notoriously reclusive, the Halsteads raised thoroughbred horses and purebred dachshunds. Halstead was still deeply addicted to morphine, but he took the drug in such controlled doses and on such a strict schedule that not even his closest students